Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. John F. Kennedy once said, "There are three things which are real: God, human folly, and laughter. The first two are beyond our comprehension, so we must do what we can with the third." And that, laughter, is the focus of tonight's program. What is American humor? How is laughter able to cross over the diverse populations of this melting pot of a nation? And what constraints do humorists face today, with an economic downturn, a period of escalating international crisis, and, of course, political correctness? Participating in our discussion tonight is Professor Emeritus Joseph Boskin of Boston University, author of Rebellious Laughter: People's Humor in American Culture. And a little bit later in this program, we'll hear Professor Boskin speaking on unheavy humor in a heavy time, recorded recently at Boston University. Also with us, Dorothea Keeling. She teaches a course called Laughing At: Understanding Good Humor Seminars at Boston's Urban College and also at Brookline Adult and Community Education. And rounding out our panel, Dick Flavin, winner of 7 Emmy Awards for writing and commentary, well known for his many years on Channel 4 and commentaries on NBC Television and CNN. Dick has also taught courses on humor at Brandeis and Harvard Universities. I want to thank you all for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
I echo that.
Excellent.
Ditto.
So how would each of you define humor? Or is it definable? Joe Boskin, let's start with you.
Oh, I think it's a natural human response to surprise, incongruity, but basically it's an attempt to develop a meaningful connection to life.
A meaningful connection to life. Dorothea, how would you...
Humor to me is something that is specific to each individual. My sense of humor is different from your sense of humor from these other two gentlemen here. It is something that you have to develop over a period of time, and it is fluid.
Fluid. And Dick Flavin, you have spoken before many audiences in many parts of the country of many kinds. How would you define
humor?
Well,
as succinctly as possible, I would say I'm damned if I know. It's different for everyone. It works differently for everyone, but we all have it. It's a natural gift with which we're born. You know, the youngest baby knows how to laugh. Long before that baby can walk or talk or crawl, that baby in a crib can laugh. It's one of God's great gifts to us, and I think it touches something spiritual in us, and so it's a valuable, valuable, underrated commodity.
In terms of laughter, as you point out, everybody does it. We all laugh at different things, though, don't we? Or do we? Are there common elements to what makes us laugh?
The difference between my laughter and Joe's laughter and yours has everything to do with your environment, what you are exposed to. If we look at TV today, we are told that this is funny. The best humor is the humor and the laughter that you yourself can produce through ordinary, everyday experiences. That is the best. But laughter, it is so refreshing when you can have a real good belly laughter. We get so much from it, therapeutically speaking, that people should use laughter to aid them in dealing with the crisis that we now find ourselves in, which is really difficult for a lot of people. We're waiting for the other shoe to drop, and that has really sort of paralyze some folks in not being able to laugh at what they used to laugh at.
Joe, you studied this over the years. Is there something to what Dorothea says in terms of is laughter kind of disappeared lately? Or?
Well, I certainly think, Dorothea, and you have put it the right way, that it's very difficult to laugh these days in light of what's happened on so many different levels. Nevertheless, one of the most important aspects of American culture is that laughter has always played a central feature in American behavior, regardless of the circumstances. Even during the Great Depression, which was, after all, a horrendous time for literally tens of millions of people, laughter was a salve, laughter was an escape, laughter was a confrontation. Laughter is, and humor is, in American society, one of the centralizing features of American society.
Yeah, and in this country, you're encouraged to laugh at authority and at the government. And in many, many societies, in many, many countries, it can get you in a lot of trouble.
It seems to me that a lot of humor in time past was based on ethnic stereotyping. Did you hear the one about the little and you'd fill in the blank and somebody would come up with a line and everybody would laugh? I think a lot of that has disappeared from American society. Let's talk about where it came from, why it flourished, and what's happening to it now.
It is still there, but it is in closed circles. Your closest friends, your co-workers, they still tend to do that. But on a large scale, in the public domain, it is something that people are reluctant to do. We have been traumatized because of the situation that happened. The thing that needs to happen is we need to have some distance. We can laugh at what has happened to us in the past, regardless of the circumstances, but the magnitude in which this recent one has happened, we need distance from the incident before we can look back and laugh. But I have to share with you, the day that 9/11 happened, my sister and I were, we were depressed and we were sad. And there was like a somberness because of the dreadful situation. And so we came up with a way in which we could deal with this particular issue. And so we came up with a way in which we can make flying much more safer. And so I said, well, we're just going to have everybody go on the airplane buck naked. Whoops, there it is. You know, we don't have to worry about anything, you know. And we laughed, and we laughed. And it was such a release because up to that point in time, we were so on edge. You know, the fight or flight, if you're not going to move to try to help yourself, all of those stress hormones are building up in your system.
Well, not only that, but it would sure cut down the lines at the metal detector.
It sure would.
One of the things that Dorothea spoke to, though, was in using humor that way, that's using it as a tool. Mm-hmm. And using it for purposes such as ethnic purposes, derogatory humor, that's using it as a weapon. And humor is a little bit, I think, like religion in that it touches something spiritual in us that we really don't understand, and it can be such a positive force for good. It can be equally destructive. It has been used from time immemorial to drive people apart, to put people down, it's a dangerous thing. It's as religion can be a dangerous thing.
So, Dick Flavin, I hear you saying that it's a two-edged sword.
Sure, it is.
It cuts for and cuts against.
Yeah.
Let's go back to what you said a little earlier, Dorothea, that within closed circles, ethnic humor flourishes.
Oh, sure.
As long as everyone within that circle understands. Mm-hmm. Joe, has it always been that way?
No. It has not always been that way. As you know, political correctness has changed the situation dramatically. And I must say that I'm on the side of political correctness in this situation. That is to say, derogatory humor has been driven from the public airwaves, which is the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Because, indeed, it has been a terrible cutting force in American society, as Dick has said. Ridicule is the worst weapon in the weapon of human repertory. And so I think this is very good. On the other hand, it does not make us aware of what's actually going on underneath the scenes. That is, to what extent does stereotyping continue to exist and how can we deal with it? So it cuts both ways. But stereotyping was used mainly because this is a pecking order society. In order for groups to work themselves up into society, they had to be subject first to the order of ridicule. And every society, every group that came into American society was subject to this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, two groups, unfortunately, were subject across the centuries, and one was women and the other were blacks.
Continues to be.
Exactement.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas, and we're talking about humor and laughter in a very serious time. And we're doing that with Professor Emeritus of Boston University, Joseph Boskin, Dorothea Keeling, who teaches laughing at understanding good humor at Urban College and also at the Brookline Adult and Education, Community Education, and Dick Flavin, who holds 7 Emmys for commentary. And Dick, I think, unless I'm mistaken, you make your living with humorous presentations all over the country.
Yeah, it's a pretty good racket, huh?
That's how Dorothy and I...
You just give him a little wink and a blink, show him your cufflinks, and
can we become a member of your enterprise?
Show me the money.
Dick, you've been doing this for years. I mean, ever since you left Channel 4, essentially. How has it changed in that time? How have your audiences changed? How has your humor changed and reaction to it?
Political humor has become much harsher as the business of politics has become nastier, and people don't want to hear it. People don't want to hear it. I mean, it makes me sad because political humor is, by its nature, has a barb to it because it's commentary. It's it's satire. But now, really, to get a laugh, you get a kind of, you know, get yourself involved in character assassination. And, you know, I buy the system. You know, I believe what Churchill said, you know, that democracy is the worst form of government ever invented, except for all those other forms which have been invented over the years. So it makes me sad, and so, I don't – it's harder to market it because people don't – you know, people don't buy it anymore.
Yeah. So it's okay if you simultaneously knock both Republicans and Democrats. That will get a laugh. But if you take a – partisan.
Well, so much of it has become personal.
It's
personal
to
the individual.
So if you go beyond to the, I see. So that's what the problem is.
Yeah, that's what the problem is. And it's in the last 15 years or so, and I don't know if you can, you know, hang the hook of guilt on anyone in particular, but one that I think about who I think deserves a good share of it is Newt Gingrich. That the dialogue in Congress does not exist anymore, let alone with humor. I mean, they don't, you know, there's not much going back and forth between different sides as there was for the first 200 years of the country.
So what do you talk about, Dick? I mean, you make your living, Dick.
The human condition. The human condition. And I talk about using humor as a strategy in business and in life, because if you can use your humor to engender not necessarily a belly laugh, but just a grin and a nod of approval from people, you're halfway through the door. Whether you're dealing with your kids or whether you're dealing with co-workers or your boss or prospects, humor is a great door opener, because you can't be angry and laughing at the same time.
Okay. This is true.
You know, I don't know if you're aware of what Dorothea does, but she has to deal with the toughest audience in this country, in this connection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me tell you what I do.
Oh, great.
My full-time job, I work for ABCD Health Services as the HIV STD Prevention Program Coordinator, and my responsibility is to outreach to and provide what they call health reduction risk workshops. And so I outreach to intravenous drug users, alcoholics, women sex workers, inmates, and professors. And they, when you allow them the opportunity to talk and you listen to them, they have the same issues, concerns as I do, but they have done something that really changed their lives. And they have a wonderful sense of humor. I know a lot of folks who are in jail at South Bay who have such wonderful sense of humor. And when I present any topic, I talk about the systems and how the systems play a role in everybody's situation in life. But they can laugh at it. And actually, I started my program, Laughter's the Best Medicine, when I worked for MCI Framingham. I was the HIV coordinator. There was a lot of stigma about HIV. None of the women would talk to me. I had to create a way for the women to approach me. So I created Laughter as the Best Medicine. It was just very simple, really loose.
And true.
And true. And they would talk about situations that were extremely funny. Happened at MCI Framingham. We told jokes. We talked about what happened to us today, what's going on with our kids. It was very, very successful, but what I got out of it was the opportunity to do my good work, which was have those women come to me and talk to me about their concerns about HIV infection.
This goes back to what Dick was saying about a door opener, whether it's prospects or people you want to help. All right. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Dorothea Keeling, Dick Flavin, and Joe Boskin and I are talking about humor and laughter and our current situation, what's happened to it, what's changed. One of my, I must say this, and I'll probably, it may not be politically correct, but one of my favorite humorists over the years was Don.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Andrew Dice Clay. In addition to Don Knotts, it was Don Rickles.
Oh.
Now, Rickles, went against everything that, you know, we've been talking about, which was that humor should be bringing people together, and yet somehow He did it in such a way that people enjoyed it without being hurt.
Well, that's because it was equal opportunity insult.
Yeah, you can insult them back.
He excluded nobody. It was totally inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew that underneath was not a rancorous individual, but a lovable man.
Yes, mm-hmm. and to see him work in a club, he always put that part of it into the act, so that everyone was aware all the way through that this wasn't on the level.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. But he overturned stereotypical humor.
Yes,
because he took the barb away from it,
mm-hmm.
and made it lovable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it became acceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no one who was banning
for his fans. It became acceptable for people who liked his brand of humor. It's acceptable. We have high humor and we have low humor, and his humor would be considered low.
Give me an example of high humor, Dorothy.
High humor is somebody like a Bill Cosby, where he takes everyday situations and he makes that humorous and funny, where low humor humiliates, it degrades, it shames, it makes people feel guilty and bad about themselves. It's a situation where people feel that they're superior by putting people down. But high humor is the best humor. And there's a handful of comedians who use high humor.
Cosby's humor, especially the child, I started mm-hmm. out as a child, mm-hmm. and a great big chicken heart and the rest of it, that's universal humor.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's not a child that hasn't felt that, mm-hmm. Whatever group.
Exactly.
Do we see much universal humor these days?
Only when it comes to children. Children have 3 to 5 years at most to be funny and to enjoy life. I'm serious.
Well,
after that,
how can I reclaim my childhood?
Well, come to my class. After that,
I'd like to enroll now.
After that, there are restrictions that are put upon the child because they got to go out into society and they have to sit down and pay attention to learn.
So these are the constraints that
That's
once
right.
we lose
Social
that open freedom
exactly.
of the child,
the age of 5.
Just like that.
Mm-hmm.
What other constraints do people
Well, face? I sometimes think that many of us were born with that sense of humor, which doesn't mean that we're all innately funny,
mm-hmm.
but it's a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate what humor is. And I think through the years, too many of us depress that or repress it.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, I think, in societies, I cannot speak about others except America, is that that playfulness seems to give way to work
mm-hmm.
or to institutional life, in which playfulness is not recognized as an acceptable characteristic. So you have to play outside of the places where you work rather
mm-hmm.
than inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what seems to be lost in America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have a whole sequence, and we'll hear it in a little while, Joe, about what's the difference between prison and work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I can get back to Cosby, and Dorothy is absolutely right, so I think, namely that these are storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
People like, they are storytellers.
Yes.
And they are rare in American society. It's the one line humorist which has taken over. But people like, Richard Pryor and Garrison Keillor
mm-hmm.
and so on are storytellers, and their stories are writ large. They mm-hmm. cut across all of us, regardless of race, religion, place, and so on.
Yeah, when you hear Garrison Keillor say, "Where all the children are above average," everybody understands. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're talking about the state of humor and laughter in modern-day America, and we're doing that with Professor Joe Boskin, Dorothea Keeling, and Dick Flavin. In time past, some of the definitions of humor that I'd like you to react to, if you will. Here's what Will Rogers said. Everything is funny as long as it is happening to someone else.
And this is true.
Particularly banana peel humor. Yeah.
The low humor, Oliver Hardy and Stan Laurel.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
All right, good.
You know, when Reagan was shot, remember the assassination mm-hmm. attempt mm-hmm. in 1981, he put on a remarkable performance. He thought he was, close to death. And nevertheless, he pulled out humor in the most remarkable mm-hmm. way. He said to his wife, Nancy, honey, I forgot to duck.
Yeah.
Before he was operated on, he looked up at the dying and said, "I hope you're all Republicans."
Yes.
And so on. So I think that's as what.
All right.
He used humor once in international diplomacy And it might have helped to change the world when they finally had the first summit meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev. Reagan, as you remember, during his first term in office, wouldn't have anything to do with the Soviets and coined the phrase the evil empire, and he'd built his reputation on his staunch anti-communism. And then things got to the point where we had to start talking because we had found a spy in the Russian embassy and we arrested him. And then, remember, the Russians went and arrested Nikolai Stanovich over in the correspondent for Newsweek over there. So they finally have the first summit, and everyone is – the whole international community is waiting with bated breath to see what is going to come with this new, tough, young Soviet leader and the old – anti-communism war horse, and they go in for their first meeting, and they're in there for hours, and they come out with their arms around each other and going to have their next meeting and already setting up the next summit. Well, it turns out Reagan told them a story to open up, and the story was there was a Russian and an American, and they were talking about freedom. And the American said, we have real freedom in my country. I can walk into the president's office, and I can say, Mr. President, I don't like the way you're running the country. And the Russian said, we have the same freedom in my country. I can walk into the president's office and I can say, Mr. President, I don't like the way Reagan is running his country. And then Gorbachev, you know, he had his staff, oh, you got to get me a story for the next session. You know,
yes, so,
and,
yes.
And the beginnings of a bonding, you know, it turned out to be a personal friendship between Gorbachev and Reagan. And it led, if someone had said to you at the beginning of 1985, and when Ronald Reagan was starting his second term in office, that within 5 years the walls would come tumbling down and there would be no more Iron Curtain, you'd say that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You'd say that's crazy. Mm-hmm.
And it began with that meeting and
it
two people.
It began with that meeting. I'm not saying that's what caused it. There were many other things, but it helped to oil the way.
So against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. Dick Flavin, Dorothea Keeling, Joe Boskin. How about this one? A leader without a sense of humor is like the man who mows the cemetery. There are tens of thousands underneath him, but nobody's listening.
I like that. Who said that?
Yes.
Did you make that up?
Did you just make that up?
No. I borrowed it, and I forgot to write down the fellow's name.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Call me the Milton Berle.
Oh, boom.
It was Henny Youngman.
But is that true? Yes. Is that true? I'm trying to think of leaders who have, to a more or less degree, lacked a sense of humor.
And well, the most effective leaders in American society have been those who had a very profound and fine and splendid sense of humor.
Even in your close circles, the people that you tend to socialize with are those that make you laugh and have a good sense of who they are and can really take life lightly.
I think there's been a very profound change in American society in this particular respect. History moves on, and the kind of humor that the younger generations laugh at is not the kind that we laughed at. So you really have to say that it's really hard to judge as to what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean about fluidity, that humor is fluid. We can go back and we can rerun some of I Love Lucy and still fall down laughing because of the brand of laughter and humor that was engendered in those series. Today's humor they have canned laughter. They tell you what is funny, and some of the stuff that they try to trigger you to laugh at is not funny. A lot of the humor deals with physical aspect of a person, how he or she looks, whether their sexual orientation, what type of job they have. So they're attacking that person for things that sometimes people have no control over.
Here's Benjamin de Caceres, though. Progress is nothing but the victory of laughter over dogma.
That's too heavy to figure out.
That doesn't float my boat.
So the subtext of that is to laugh at ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay. Yeah, yeah. Which is, we're back with the rebellious laughter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's the great line by Lincoln, who suffered from depression through most of his presidency and also was, of course, famous for for using humor strategically.
Oh, yes.
And there were joke books put out during his time, Old Abe's, you know, jokes and all that sort of thing. And was asked once why he did this all the time. And he said, "I laugh because I must not cry."
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. What about the future of humor? I mean, you've been following this Joe Boskin for all of your working life. You've made it your field as a very young man. And what direction do you think it's going? You did for humor what Pete Seeger did for folk music, although not at exactly the same time.
It's robust. It's inventive. There's no question in my mind that American humor is a mainstay and will continue in its way. And here you have two very important people here, Dorothy and Dick, who actually use it in their lives in many important ways, you know, professionally as well as personally. No, American humor is one of the most important characteristics of American behavior.
Dorothy?
I think if people understand the benefits that you get from humor and laughter, they would take the opportunity to educate themselves about how they can use humor to deal with stress, because it is very, very therapeutic. And actually, I firmly believe that when a child is born, that child's ability to laugh helps that person, that young child, to develop his or her immune system.
Hmm. Well, you know, when that child is laughing, there's no place on earth that's happier than a room in which a baby is laughing, because everyone in the room, it's contagious. Mm-hmm. And there are human behaviorists who have written that this is a child's first sense of empowerment, that little being understands that he's affecting the behavior of other people. And there's a wonderful line that every third grade kid knows, you know, laugh and the world laughs with you, weep and you weep alone. And it's from a poem, you know, by Ella Wheeler Wilcox about 125 years ago, that it's the wonder isn't that line is so famous, but that the poem is so little known, because it speaks to something universal to all of us, no matter what century we were born in. And the poem is, "Laugh and the world laughs with you, weep and you weep alone, for the sad old earth must borrow its mirth, but has trouble enough of its own. Mm-hmm. Sing and the hills will answer, sigh it is lost in the air, the echoes bound to a joyful sound, but shrink from a voicing care. Mm-hmm. Rejoice and men will seek you, grieve and they'll turn and go, they'll take full measure from your pleasure, but they do not want your woe."
Yay!
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Dick Flavin. On that note, thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Ted,
very much. Trying to define the indefinable. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. We turn now to Professor Boskin's presentation of numerous examples of current humor, as he spoke before an audience recently at Boston University. Professor Boskin begins with a quote from writer and essayist E.B. White.
"Whatever else an American believes or disbelieves about himself, he is absolutely sure he has a sense of humor." I thought I would put that to the test in light of what's been happening in American society and the world at large, namely about the sense of humor, because it has been one of my areas of study for the past three decades or so, and I've come to the conclusion that humor is one of the most important central indices of American society. It is a cultural language. It is the cement, I think, of this heterogeneous society. Humor plays one of the most important roles in American psyche and American communication, American behavior. And so I thought I would take E.B. White's comment and put it to the test in light of what's been happening. But then how do you do this? How do you siphon out from all of the humor that exists in American society, and we are surrounded, if not inundated, by humor? How does one do this? And then I thought, well, this is the beginning of the semester, of the academic year. This is when we all get reacquainted with ABC, because every time I returned to elementary school, they went over the ABCs again. So I thought I would take the alphabet and apply it in that particular way. In short, a joke for every letter of the alphabet that has come my way. Now, you must understand that coming my way means from a variety of sources. I am the messenger here, and I do not wish to be killed being the messenger. Humor comes to me from late-night telephone calls, surreptitious people, anonymous students, from graffiti. I go to every bathroom I can, and I look for graffiti on the walls. I get it through the mails. I get it through the Internet. I actually even pick it up when I eavesdrop on people's conversation in locker rooms. And there are, as you can imagine, hundreds if not thousands of items that come my way. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but that's what American humor is, an exaggeration. But certainly hundreds. So all I can tell you is that I've siphoned out from these vast files that have come my way the past year or two, you know, typical representative jokes, anecdotes, stories, and so on to illustrate my point about E.B. White. And this will give you an overview of what's happening in American society, which we can sum up at the very end. So we begin with A for advice. And the advice sort of comes from Dave Barry. Dave Barry is one of the leading, as you know, humorous columnists in the United States. And this particular item appeared in the newspaper. Like the rest of us, Dave Barry couldn't find a lot to laugh about immediately following September 11. All I could think about was the attacks, said Barry. I also thought no one like me could ever be funny again. I thought maybe I should become a fireman but not write booger jokes anymore. But how to handle September 11th. Barry decided the answer was to give 2001 a total skip. The more I thought about it, the more I realized I would have to deal with 9/11, but I also realized I couldn't be funny about it. And this was the prognosis of many people, that irony was gone in American society and that this was the end of American humor for a while. However, Barry has now had second thoughts. Barring other catastrophes, the 54-year-old Pulitzer Prize winner plans to resurrect his year-end opus in 2002. That is this year. You can always count on a lot of weird things to happen to write about. He says, people ask me if I ever run out of ideas. I tell them only if I stop reading the newspapers. And so I have been reading the newspapers along with other things, and we start off B. Therefore, after A for advice of returning to American humor, we start off with Bushisms. This after the President of the United States, George W. Bush, who holds the distinction of being the only president in American history ever to not know his native language. We passed from B to C, and so I give you the subject of diet. It's a relief to know the truth after all those conflicting medical studies. The Japanese eat very little fat and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The French eat a lot of fat and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Chinese drink very little red wine and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Italians drink excessive amount of red wine and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Germans drink a lot of beers and eat a lot of sausages and fats, and they suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. Conclusion? Eat and drink what you like. Speaking English is apparently what kills you. We pass over to E and F, and E and F go together in the sense that everybody in America these days fusses about fidelity or infidelity, but I haven't gotten to I yet because I have another thing for I, and therefore you have to put up with just fidelity. And there are all kinds of jokes, stories, and movies, I mean TV shows, you name it, about fidelity. I happen to like the letters that come in to the late Ann Landers about fidelity. She has them there almost, I think, on a weekly basis, or used to in any case. And I have collected them all. So this letter recently appeared. Dear Ann Landers, I am reminded of a situation of a friend of mine got himself into. Every year during hunting season, Jack would head out to bring down a big buck. Jack's wife was always suspicious of how much hunting actually took place on those trips, so one year she decided to put him to the test. After packing his bags, as she always had, Jennifer gave Jack a hug and the usual be careful speech and sent him on his way. 4 days later, when Jack returned home, Jennifer wanted all the details of the trip. After filling her in about his grandiose killings and so on, and how many bucks he actually, you know, leveled and skinned and took home and that sort of thing, he said, "By the way, you didn't pack me any underwear." She then reached down, picked up his shotgun case, and opened it. There, folded neatly, under the gun was the underwear. If I'm not mistaken, Jack now hunts a lot closer to home. But Ann Landers says, "My hunch is that Jack's hunting days are over." I am a historian. Nobody pays attention to historians. And the joke is that historians don't know it. That leads me to I, and I is connected to J. These two go together in a phrase, and the phrase is, "I was only joking." So, this particular newspaper appeared in the New York Times about a month and a half ago. An American West passenger was escorted off a plane this week before takeoff after she made a remark about the pilot's sobriety. The remark, which the woman said was a joke, was an apparent reference to an incident of last week in which two American West pilots were charged with operating an aircraft under the influence of alcohol. And so when the woman boarded the plane, the first thing she said to the attendant, she said, "Have you checked your crew for sobriety?" She was escorted off. Now, the intriguing part of American humor is that it basically constantly pushes the boundaries. Every society has its taboos and its prohibitions, and so has this society, but there has been a social revolution in American humor in the past 30 to 40 years. Nevertheless, there are always boundaries, and boundaries connect up to historical circumstances, and here is the clearest case: I was only joking. Sometimes one should be very cautious about what one says, even in an open society. Now, this brings me, therefore, in an open society, to lawyers. Lawyer jokes have been staples in American society ever since the 17th century, where they took their place alongside of clergymen jokes. Clergymen jokes have since disappeared, but lawyers go on. And so I give you the latest joke that has come to me. It seems that a man called up a lawyer and asked him, "How much do you charge for three questions?" The lawyer replied, $400. The man said, "Isn't that a bit steep?" The lawyer says, "I guess so. What's your third question?" This leads me to the second half of the alphabet, leading down to marriage. And so I give you children, boys and girls, age 5 to about 12, and their responses to questions put to them. All of these people were in elementary school. So we start off with the first question: how do you decide who to marry? This is Kirsten, age 10. No person really decides before they grow up who they're going to marry. God decides. God decides it all way before, and you get to find out later who you're stuck with. Alan, aged 10. You got to find somebody who likes the same stuff you do like. If you like sports, she should like it. that you like sports and she should keep the chips and dip coming. What is the right age to get married? Camille, age 10. 23 is the best age because you know the person forever by then. How can a stranger tell if two people are married? Derek, aged 8. You might have to guess based on whether they seem to be yelling at the same kids. What do you think your mom and dad have in common? Lori, age 8, said, both don't want any more kids. What do most people do on a date, is the question that was asked. Lynette, age 8, said, dates are for having fun. And people should use them to get to know each other. Even boys have something to say if you listen long enough. And Martin, age 10, responded to that question by saying, on the first date, they just tell each other lies. And that usually gets them interested. What would you do on a first date that was turning sour, was the question asked. And Craig, age 9, said, I'd run home and play dead. The next day I would call the newspapers and make sure they wrote about me in the dead columns. And we get to the question, is it better to be single or married? And the answer from Anita, age 9, is, it's better for girls to be single but not for boys. Boys need someone to clean up after them. And lastly, how would the world be different if people didn't get married? There sure would be a lot of kids to explain, wouldn't there, said Calvin. We are truly a nation of contradictions. Maybe all are in some fashion, but this one even more so, because of its pluralistic nature, because of its complexity, because of its history, and so on. Incongruity is one of the main streams of American humor. But I already dealt the I, so this is O only in America, and I give you examples of incongruity only in America. Only in America can a pizza get to your house faster than an ambulance. Only in America are there handicapped parking places in front of a skating rink. Only in America do drugstores make the sick walk all the way to the back of the store to get their prescriptions, while healthy people can buy cigarettes at the front. Only in America do people order double cheeseburgers, large fries, and a Diet Coke. You get an A for that one. Only in America do we buy hot dogs in packages of 10 and buns in packages of 8. Only in America do we use the word politics to describe the process so well. But you see, poli, in Latin meaning many, and ticks meaning blood-sucking creatures. Only in America do they have a drive-up ATM machine with braille lettering. We turn to S for stereotyping, because that is also one of the main motifs in American society. This particular graffito says, reasons to be a man. Phone conversations are over in 30 seconds flat. You know stuff about tanks. A 5-day vacation requires only one suitcase. You can open up all your own jars. Dry cleaners and haircutters don't rob you blind. You can go to the bathroom without a support group. You don't have to learn to spell a new last name. You can leave the motel bed unmade. You can kill your own food. And wedding plans take care of themselves. The direct opposite of that, and this comes actually, this is not an example of folk humor, which I've been actually dealing with the entire time. These are actually quotations from people whom you will recognize immediately. This is to smart women everywhere. I am not offended by all the dumb blonde jokes because I know I'm not dumb. And I also know I'm not blonde. Dolly Parton. Erica John. You see a lot of smart guys with dumb women, but you hardly ever see a smart woman with a dumb guy. Wendy Lieberman. I've been on so many blind dates, I should get a free dog. Irma Bombeck. Never lend your car to anyone to whom you have given birth. Liz Winston. I think, therefore, I'm single. Elaine Boozler. When women are depressed, they can either eat or go shopping. Men invade another country. Marianne Pearson. Behind every successful man is a surprised woman. I can't not end without Zsa Zsa Gabor, one of my favorites. I am a marvelous housekeeper. Every time I leave a man, I keep his house. When Shelley called and asked me to give a lecture about American humor, she talked about heavy times, and I said, well, why not label the unheavy humor for heavy times? Right? And I felt very satisfied. Rather than light humor, like light beer, I thought, oh, unheavy. And then somebody said to me, you idiot, there's no such word. And so the joke is on you. This lecture is ungrammatical. This leads me to W. What is the relationship between prison and work? And the answer is, well, it's all mixed up. Because in prison, you spend the majority of your time in an 8x10 cell. At work, you spend the majority of your time in a 6x8 cubicle. In prison, you get 3 meals a day. At work, you only get a break for 1 meal and you pay for it. In prison, you get time off for good behavior. At work, you get more work for good behavior. In prison, you can watch TV and play games. At work, you get fired for watching TV and playing games. This leads me to X, Y, and Z, in case you haven't noticed. Well, X is the unknown quantity in all of humor. And Y connects up to that universal and cosmic question about why, which we all have to deal with. And that is a tough one. And this is where humor comes in. Because I give you one of the most important statements ever written about humor. And it comes from Christopher Fry's play, The Lady's Not for Burning. At the very end of the play, he has two of his main characters talking to one another. And Thomas sort of says to his friends, not just rhetorically, but pointedly, for God's sake, he says, for God's sake, shall we laugh? And then for what reason? And his friend answers, well, for the reason of laughter. Since laughter is surely the surest touch of genius in creation. And that, I think, is the essence of humor, no matter what theory you wish to apply to it. So that takes care of X and Y. But what about Z? Now there, I'm sure you're puzzled. Are there any jokes about Z? I looked in vain, but then I thought, wait a minute, what does Z stand for as a symbol? Not the mark of Zorro, please. I mean, I grew up with Zorro. No, remember those little blurbs above people's heads when they start to snore and they fall asleep? They snooze. Snooze. Z is for snoozing. I want to thank all of you. I don't see any of it above your heads for not snoozing during my lecture. And so this leads me to my final conclusion about the nature of American humor and whether or not, indeed, it satisfies E.B. White's dictum that whatsoever an American believes or disbelieves about himself, he surely has a sense of humor. I would like to append that by saying not only does he have a sense of humor, dash, and he, she, or maybe is it he, her, has a joke to tell. There is literally a joke for every situation in this country. I kid you not. I am absolutely astonished, and I mean this obviously in both literal and figurative sense. There is a joke for every circumstance, no matter how bad, no matter how good, no matter the subject, whether it's taboo or not taboo. American humor inundates us. You can see it most clearly in the proliferation of comedy clubs, sitcoms, television, jokes, cartoons, comic strips, on the editorial pages. We are surrounded by humor. The interesting thing about it, or perhaps that's not the proper word, interesting, the cruel thing about it is that we don't take it seriously. That is to say, we think it should be funny. Now, humor is funny, but it has that component of the tragic to it. There's a relation. The Greeks had it just right with their very famous symbol, as you know, in their dramas, the two faces that are connected and the mouth that goes up and then down. Humor is connected to tragedy, which is precisely what happened within this past year. All the pronouncements about the death of humor have turned out to be, of course, totally unwarranted, because humor is one of the most flexible, inventive, multifaceted, vibrant things in American society. And so it's clearly that humor has come to play a very important role in giving us perspective, because that ultimately is what humor is about, not just a personal way to deal with the world and to cope, but a national way also to give us perspective that indeed we are human, and to be human means that we cry and we laugh, not simultaneously, but certainly together. So thank you very much.
Professor Emeritus Joseph Boskin speaking on Unheavy Humor in a Heavy Time, recorded recently at Boston University. Earlier in the program, we spoke with Professor Boskin, teacher Dorothea Keeling, and writer and commentator Dick Flavin. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from John Hoder, Michael Garth, and Andy Farnsworth. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.